The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Transmission of Light, the 17th ancestor, Rahulata, or as we pronounce it, Raghurata. In attendance on Kanadeva, Rahulata experienced enlightenment on hearing about a past cause. The verse. What a pity the eye of the way is not clear. Losing oneself, repaying others, one's retribution is not yet ended. I mentioned a little bit about this collection in the earlier talk this week. This is a Keizan Zenji. A few generations after Dogen compiled this. And the main source, I believe, is another text called The Transmission of the Lamp, which was compiled in China very early on. And it's a compilation of stories about Zen ancestors going back to the Buddha. And a lot of it is, I don't know where the material came from, because in the early years, it was not, things were not written down, keeping. It's not necessarily to be taken literally. It's very, a lot of the stories are quite miraculous. There are all kinds of supernatural, magical things that take place. As in this case, Kanadeva, Rahulata's teacher, was traveling and came to an area, to Kapilavastu, where there was a wealthy man who in his garden had a tree that grew mushrooms, fungus, and they were excellent to eat. But only the elder and his second son, Rahulata, could eat it. The other members of the family couldn't even see them. And as soon as they ate it, it would regrow. So it had this ongoing, constant source of these delicious mushrooms. And when Kanadeva came, he often, it's said that the master would come to an area based on a prediction or a sense that there was some auspiciousness there. And so it was in this case. And so he came to this house and asked, and the elder asked Kanadeva, well, what was happening? Why was this happening? What's the story on this mushroom? And Kanadeva said, many years ago, you gave a donation to a Buddhist monastic whose understanding of the way and practice of the way was not very strong, was not very clear, was a little... was a little shy, shall we say. And because the monastic had received alms in that kind of a mind state, when the monastic died, they were reborn as this tree, producing these mushrooms as a way to repay. Because they hadn't been able to repay in their life as a practicing monastic, because their practice wasn't very strong. And so, it says, since only you and your second child, Rahulata, provide offerings with pure sincerity, you're the only ones who are able to actually see and partake of this mushroom, receive that offering. And Kanadeva asked the elder how old he was, and the man said he was 79 years old. And he said, entering the way, if one doesn't enter the truth, one returns one's body to requite the alms of the faithful. When your years are 81, then the tree will no longer produce mushroom. And so the elder felt very beholden to Kanadeva, and said, I'm a little old to renounce my life and become a monastic and ask you to be my teacher, but I'll give you my second son. And so, who evidently was willing. And so Rahulata became his disciple. And Keizan Zenji, in his commentary on this, really focuses his whole commentary on the sort of takes up that point of this monastic's heart of the way as being not really equal to the offering that was being made. In other words, it wasn't really a sincere, pure heart of seeking the way, and really emphasizes that in his commentary. And he says, in ancient and modern times, this story has often been brought up to admonish students who vainly mix in with the pure flow, that is the life of the home leaver, without shame or conscience, who wastefully accept the charity of the faithful without having any knowledge or discernment. Really, one should be ashamed of this. And so we might look at this as, because it's to look at it not just in terms of a monastic life, but in terms of what is our responsibility in this life? Do we have, are we born into this world with certain responsibilities just by virtue of being alive, being a human being, living within human communities, living on this great earth? The Buddha taught that there is a fourfold Sangha, the male and female monastic, male and female lay, and that the role of these, not in taking into account non-binary folks, but the relationship between these communities was an interdependent one, that the monastics relied on the lay community for their support, so they begged for their food and for provisions to have. They were restricted in terms of what they could have. They could have their robes, they could have some sewing materials, they could have some medicine, very, very spare. But they relied on the lay Sangha for that, and the lay Sangha relied on the monastics for the Dharma, because the monastics were really, for many, many hundreds of years, were considered the practitioners of the Dharma in the way that we are all practicing here together. And the lay Sangha's practice was in large part to support the monastics. And we could see, as Keizan Zenji makes a point of, how this could lead to complacency. So the monastics could take for granted their lives, the support that they're being given, and then that complacency would, in a sense, influence or infect their mind in terms of their practice. Because if one is practicing vigorously, then we are consciously cultivating a mind that is endowed with gratitude and mutual respect and understanding our mutual dependence. In the same vein, the lay community might take the monastics for granted. I remember many, many years ago, I was traveling with Jimon to see her family down near Washington, D.C., and we went to a community, a Buddhist community, run by a Tibetan Buddhist woman teacher. And it was dazzling. I mean, there was a lot of, it seemed like there was quite a bit of wealth there. And this was in the very early years, and I was looking at all of this and thinking, oh my God, you know, like, we're in the wrong church. And I came back to and was telling Dada Roshi about this and sharing this with him. And I said, God, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, he said, no, we're fine. We're fine. He said, we need to work for what we earn. And our work is what we're doing right now. It's offering retreats. It's making the Dharma available, inviting people, the Sangha, to come here and practice, introducing it. He was very adamant about not relying on donations to support ourselves, as many centers do and need to do. In a sense, he took up Bai Cheng's, a day without work is a day without food, that we really needed. And when I asked him why, he said because he felt that that would keep us in the right frame of mind. It would keep us in a kind of right relationship with the monastics, with the lay, and each of us together. Because we would be really understanding how we were all here together. I still thought it would be easier in those early years. When things were slender and slim, shall we say. I remember one winter. Winters were particularly difficult because people just didn't come. It's like the attendance just whoosh, shrunk right down. And it always snowed on Friday, right when retreats were, and I would tell the registrar, when people call up to cancel, say, we don't accept cancellations. And I remember one time meeting, I was the cook, I was the tenzo, and meeting with a small group of the board, and they called me into the inner office, which was downstairs in the common room, sat me down, I thought, what is going on? And they said, can you feed the Sangha? I think it was on $100 to $150 a week. And I said, I don't know. I can try. So we tried. Kazan says, those who have, and lay, as lay students, think about this in terms of your own sort of situation, as students who have abandoned home or are home dwellers and have entered the way, even our dwelling place is not our own land. And what we eat is not ours at all. And what we wear is not, does not belong to us ultimately. Not even a drop of water, a blade of grass is to be exploited. Why? Because we are all born and raised by the land, and all the land and waters in the country belong to the ruler. So he was talking about his current political situation. And so that we're indebted to our parents, we're indebted to the nation who providing us, the ruler provides. In this sense, we might think our community, or, you know, our all the structures and systems that actually help us to live our daily lives. We're in a relationship, a mutual relationship. At such a time, heaven and earth give protection, and you naturally receive the benefit of the sun and shade energies. So if you make a half, receiving all of this, he says, so if you make a half-hearted effort to seek the Buddha Dharma and don't really repay your debt of gratitude to those who are making it possible for you to have come into this life and to be living this life, then how will you requite that debt? If you enter the way but do not have the eye of the way, if you do not have enlightened vision, if you do not aspire and practice diligently, then it's as though you're a thief. And so obviously he's trying to inspire us, to wake us up to what we're in the midst of, to the fact that we're all in a web of mutual responsibility, mutual support. And in that, you know, we might think of those responsibilities or obligations as heavy burdens, but from the Bodhisattva perspective, they just provide us with infinite ways to give, to live lives of generosity. So that debt becomes, rather than a burden, a gift, something that we can spend all of our lives trying to repay. That's the way I think about my relationship, my debt to Dada Roshi. There's nothing I could do, I feel, to repay the debt that I owe him. But I try. And so here, all that the koan is presenting us with is an attendance on Kanadeva, Rahulata, experience enlightenment on hearing about a past cause. So for the student in this collection, which is in ways can be a very difficult collection of koans, the question is, what is the question? What is the koan here? What is the student? What is the point that the student is sitting with? What dharma is this koan presenting the student to realize? What does this have to do with the nature of mind, nature of the self, with freeing ourselves? There are many koans that make it very clear what the question is. They bring you right to it. But there are others that are not like that, and that's part of the challenge, is the student has to find their way in to the mind of the koan, the heart of it, to the question of the koan. What is it that needs to be understood here? What is it that Rahulata was enlightened to in hearing about a past cause? That's all we know. A past cause. We're studying karma. How have you arrived here today? If you tried to answer that question, how have you arrived here in this life, in this form, in this particular life, at this time? How have you come to encounter this Dharma path? You know, when we're having retreats and meeting new people or just getting to know Sangha members, you know, I really enjoy asking very simple questions like, where did you grow up? Where were you born? Right? Things about their life. What work do you do? Not to define or create an identity in the person, but to hear and get a sense of what was their influences of place, of geography. Was it mountains? Was it ocean? Was it plains, big skies? Was it cold? Was it hot? And what choices has this person made in their life? Right? What paths have been traveled? And why? And what is the course of this life? Within those choices, where did it lead the person? And where did that lead them? And where did that lead them? What has gone into the formation of this being, this universe? And how has that been working? Has that person been able to really put that to use? Has it been experienced as a burden? I remember many years ago, there was a young woman who was in residence for a month, and she was leaving here to go and join one of the armed forces. And she was young, 18. She was quite young. And I asked her, I said, why? Why would you like to be in the armed forces? What made you enlist? And she said, you know, I won't have to think about what I'm going to wear every day when I wake up. And I said, and anything else? And she said, no. And of course, you know, maybe there was, and she wasn't telling, I don't know. But I thought, the basis upon which significant decisions are made. This past cause, we all have them, innumerable. Some of them sit heavily in our minds. But where do they sit? Where do they live, these past causes? Our past. We all have one. We can all tell stories about them. They come to visit us. We can create images in our mind, relive. We can describe them. And how accurate are those descriptions? When we remember something of the past, are we actually remembering what happened? It's sort of like a dream. Or do we remember what it meant to us? Or do we just remember certain parts? Or have we reshaped it to fulfill some desire that is needed in remembering that? Is there any way of actually knowing for sure? The longer I live, the less sure I am about what actually happened. Going way back. I have memories, but what do we remember? This past self. So when we're remembering past causes, past actions, we're remembering someone acting, an agent, an actor, you, others, a cast within that particular story. But where does that past self live? We can see ourselves in our mind's eye in various ages. We can see other people at various ages. But where is this past self, your younger self? But you don't have to go that far back. Where is the self that woke up this morning? All the thoughts that you might have had yesterday sitting on that cushion, or even this morning. Pleasant ones, unpleasant ones, light ones, heavy ones, where are they now? Some of them had great weight, great moment. Some of them might have undone you. Some of them might have picked you up. But where are they now? The Diamond Sutra says, past mind, present mind, future mind is ungraspable. So what is it that we are grasping at? We can't deny the influence of our past lives, our past causes. We see how they help to shape us. You know, I continually marvel, you know, particularly in listening, hearing so much about different people's lives, and sometimes about those past causes. And I marvel at the brilliance, the intelligence of our young human minds as young children, living in our own particular circumstances, particularly when those circumstances were difficult, challenging, not easy, not safe, not supportive. And the ingenuity of the mind to survive and to explain, in a sense, to create order where there might not be much, to establish a ground where there may be little ground. Whether it's daydreaming or distractedness or getting lost in books or disassociation or pleasing, being nice, all of these strategies. When at a very young age, we have very little resources. What can we do, right? We're children. And yet the brilliance of the mind and our nature to live, to survive in that situation. And then, of course, those strategies generally often get employed again and again because they work to some degree. And then as we get older, they keep being employed. They keep being employed and they become our habits, our sense of ourself, our identity. And then we bring them right through that front gate, as must be. And we employ them in practice. And to some degree, they keep working because they have been working to some degree, otherwise we would not keep using them. And to the degree that they work, we keep employing them, but to the degree that they do not work, that begins to show up more and more, as it must. And then things can really begin to change. Kazon said, when you clarify yourself, what would you call animate or inanimate? It is not past, present, or future. It's not your senses or your objects that your senses perceive or your consciousness. There is no one to stop and nothing stopped either, or no self-doing or other-doing. When you clarify yourself, what would you call this self? You really should investigate very thoroughly into this and see it with your body and your mind shed. See it with your body and mind dropped off, forgotten. See it free of your body and mind. And in order to do that, we have to see that self over and over again within the body and mind, because that's what we have to work with. It has not been shed. It has not been dropped off. And so we have to learn how to do that, how to let go of that self from within the self, how to wake up to the dream from within the dream, how to bring ourselves back into contact with this whole miracle that we call this human body, this human mind and nature, when we have distanced ourselves from it or disassociated from it or negated it, employed our strategy. He goes on to say, don't vainly be proud of having become a monastic or a lay student. Even if you avoid a flood, you'll be bothered by the fire. Even if you break away from mundane turmoil, it's still unavoidable, even in Buddhahood. And while he's speaking to monastics, his intention is to flame, bring into brighter burning the flame that is already lit, we call bodhicitta, or to light a fire that has not yet been ignited, to reinvigorate what might have become complacent, to create a question or doubt where there might not be examination. Much of the teaching is like this. It is not to tuck us sweetly into bed and say, it's all going to be okay. It is to say, it is not okay. And if we practice hard, we can see that that is okay in a way that we never imagined. And not in the way that we think. It is not complacency. And so we might rephrase that. Don't vainly be proud of being a student of the Dharma. Don't be complacent with a robe and a bowl, with a shelf full of Dharma books, with a daily meditation practice, with having a teacher. I remember a student years ago that I was talking to. I was actually having dinner with them and her partner, and we were talking, and she bragged to me that she has sat every single day since she became a student. I said, so what? What is an offering of incense? What is a robe? Why do we eat with orioki? Why do we use these forms? A word that I've never really liked very much. It's so static. It's so dead until it's not. And that is our imperative. Do not let it become something static. You know, I think that was part of an important part of Dada Roshi's creation of the Eight Gates, you know, was to bring attention, conscious attention and examination to these forms of training, these practice forms, these traditions, these wisdom vehicles. Because otherwise we come in, we're taught how to do Zazen, we come into the Zendo, we're given a liturgy book, everybody else is chanting, so we chant, everybody bows, so we bow. And maybe we question, or maybe we don't. And he wanted to try and ensure the former. That we question, not from a place of doubt. It's a very powerful thing, you know, to examine from a place of faith. I was talking to some students this morning about this. We were talking about the text, the things that we're studying, this Ango, the Karma, the book that we're studying by Trela Kelpgan. And I said, you know, in recommending that the Sangha read this book in this case, I said it's to read it from within a sense of faith, of trust, that here's a Buddhist teacher who has deep understanding, is presenting something, but also at the same time to read critically, to examine it, not just to say, read it and say, okay, everything this person says, I just accept because they said, because it's printed on the page, and to examine it, in a sense, to test it. But when we do that from a place of faith, that's a very powerful thing, as opposed to when we stand outside like as a, you know, as a cynic or a skeptic. That's a whole nother thing. It's very difficult to get anywhere that way. When you bow to your seat, or to the Sangha, to your food, what is that? There are words we can speak about this, we do, to try and offer some understanding or direction. But, you know, we can so easily get lost in those logical explanations. We can get certain information or be given certain knowledge, and it's like, oh, okay. And it ends there. That's not the point. That doesn't bring us any closer. The heart essence of everything that we do takes place within you. That's the deal. And the only way that we know that is we have to open ourselves up. We have to invite it in. We have to engage, practice in a heartfelt way. I think that's what Kaizen is pointing to here. Right? Even a rigorous tradition like ours, even living here as a monastic year after year, can become easy. That can become because the person is developing themselves and working out and freeing themselves of all the entanglements that make it hard when it doesn't need to be hard. And so it becomes more easeful. In a sense, in a very real sense, that should be happening whatever our life is. But it can become easier just because we learn how to kind of accommodate ourselves to it. And that's not its intention. And so to enter in deeply is really what we're always, should always be striving to practice, whatever the practice is. Which means there's a sense that this, whatever's in front of you, is a doorway, has something to offer. And don't know what that is. Don't name it. Don't have an idea about it, but just have a sense, a trust. There's something here. You know, when I first came here and started, you know, encountered liturgy, which was like a whole new ballgame. Like, what is this? And, you know, I had no relationship with it. I had no history of it. But the way my teacher, the way Dada Roshi talked about it, intrigued me. Because he was talking about something I didn't understand, and he was talking from a place that I had not visited. I did not know that place. But I wanted to. We are not our past, and yet our past lives within us. How it lives within us is an ever-changing thing. It can sit on our shoulders, it can be like lead in our shoes, it can feel real and fixed and intractable. It can feel like who you are. It can be like a faint scent passing by without much impact. In either case, it is ephemeral, it is flickering, its nature is without inherent obstruction, and yet we get obstructed. When we think about past causes, opportunities we have missed, things that we did or did not do, how we acted selfishly or meanly, and then in practice, we face those. They come to visit us, don't they? Don't they? You didn't ask for it, but there's a knock on the door. And you see something, an image, a memory, you feel something. There's a conversation going on that happened long ago, but it's not long ago. It's now. And that is an energy that is seeking, that is agitated, it is not at rest. It's like a being, it's like a ghost. It's seeking rest. And so we have to be skillful. We have to learn how to tend to that ghost so that it can finally rest. Kjellgren says, it comes down to seeing things as real on the conventional level, terms of our karma, but not on the ultimate level. Karma has no intrinsic reality. It doesn't exist somewhere. Our past is not a thing. It doesn't exist years ago. It doesn't exist here. But for the mind. But it is real on another level because we're experiencing it. For instance, during waking hours, we have some type of reality experience. This is real. But when we're dreaming and while the dream lasts, it also has a reality on its own. But when we wake up, it's gone. And we think to ourselves, that wasn't real, not in the way that this now is real. We differentiate them. Buddhism doesn't. It's real while it's happening in the context of the dream. The dream is real as a dream. In the same way, our everyday life experiences, that of our karma as well, are real to the extent that they are real to us. And to the extent that they are real, they will remain real until they are real no longer. Because we now experience them in a new way. We experience them in a sense, in an old way, in an ancient way, in a primordial way. We experience them as they are. Because they are not real, he says they can be overcome, which is a possibly problematic way to describe it, overcome. We often think of that as subduing, dominating, a conquest. It's not that. And so Rahulata was experiencing enlightenment on hearing about a past cause. That means when he heard about a past cause, something happened that was beyond just hearing, that was beyond just having a memory or seeing an image, something that was real, something that was coming to afflict him, something that was separate. That what happened in that moment liberated his body and mind, and it liberated the body and mind of self, of others. It liberated him from the illusion that past, present, and future exist somewhere. And so to free ourselves, we have to encounter each thing as it arises. Practice what appears before you. It's a basic principle. That's why when we, you know, in a sense, that's why everyone has a root practice, right? So when you go to the Kirshan, you know what you're going to do. You don't know what's going to happen. Try not to know what's going to happen. Right? Free yourself of that. But you know what you're going to practice, right? And so that's in a sense what you put before you, your breath, awareness, the koan, the four immeasurables, whatever your meditation is, that's what you put before you. And then at different moments, something else appears. Something else appears before you. That is the result of our karma in the past. It's not random, it's not. Bodhidharma says it makes sense. The more and more we understand ourselves, mind, karma, it makes sense. We understand. And that this which is arising is arising within the conditions of this body and mind, this moment, this time of day, this session, within the community of this Sangha. All of those have influence. The whole of the week, the whole of the Anga, the whole of your life, all of that is having influence in that moment. And when we do feel bound, when it becomes more real in a sense than we can easily renounce, release, then we have other ways of practicing it. So we practice atonement, we practice forgiveness, we practice liturgy. This is oftentimes what happens in face-to-face teaching. The teacher helps a student to bring different forms of practice on the path of going beyond attachment, of letting go. So that we can shift. An old teacher said, if you meet and come up against an immovable mountain that won't yield, you yield. If something doesn't shift, you shift. Kazan says, so it is not necessary to ask about others, to be concerned about getting into other people's business. Right? Sitting here on this cushion, it's your seat, it's your mountain. It's your mind. Just look back, he says, just look back on your very first determination of mind. Look into yourself and see what is right and what is not right. This is why it is said that it is hard to be as careful of the end as of the beginning. If you really would be a student, as a beginner, then how would you not be a person of the way? I've always loved that phrase, that section. Just look back on your very first determination of mind, the first rising of your bodhicitta. So many moments I would get caught up in something, competitiveness, judging, here in the Zendo, making mountains and worlds and stories and dramas and all real. And then sometimes I would stop and say, is that why you came here? Did you come here to win this race? Are we in a race here? Is that what we're doing? And as soon as I asked myself the question, the answer was immediate. No. I remembered. And then I was able to look back and see, okay, what is right and what is not right here? What is important and what is not important? Where do I need to be directing myself? What is not my business? And what is my business? It is hard to be as careful of the end as the beginning. We adapt, we accommodate, we become accustomed to. And of course, that's going to happen, right? And there can be a lot of strength and power in that. It can help us to relax. It can help us to feel secure, like we belong, like this is your home, is your spiritual home, like that is your seat. And it is always here waiting for you. This is your practice. The Buddha was enlightened so you could do this. But not to settle in to a place of dullness. And so much of training is really to continually revive us, keep the juices flowing, right? Let's not forget what is right and not right, what is important and not important. Kazan says, good people, we have been lucky enough to meet the true teaching of the Buddha. This is more rare than meeting a tiger in the middle of a city. It is supposed to be rarer than the single blooming of the Urubara flower, which blooms once in 3,000 years. I remember reading looking up Urubara, and there, one of the links was a guy who said, oh, that's just ridiculous. And I thought, yeah, it is ridiculous. And that's not the point. Concentrating carefully and investigating thoroughly, let your eye of the way become pure and clear. We have been lucky enough, we are lucky enough, we are lucky in this very moment to have encountered this Dharma, to have encountered a place of practice, a Sangha to practice with, and to be of a body and mind in which we can do that. And we might think, oh, of course, we should look closer. Things change in an instant. And what we never thought of before now becomes a significant concern. What was easy before is now not so easy. What was always available was not available in the same way. The consistency of our lives can lull us into a kind of idea that's guaranteed. We're owed that. I don't think so. And that's what Buddhism from the beginning has been unafraid of. Unafraid of. So that when we do go to bed, we can go to bed peacefully, with our eyes open.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.